You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending June 6th. I'm Joe Elia. On Offer is a roundup of the week's news, along with a discussion we hope you'll find of interest. This week's is about ghost writers and guest writers. If you'd like to leave us a comment, call 617-440-4374. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. On to the news roundup. The big news came at week's end when the New England Journal of Medicine released early a brace of research and commentary on diabetes. Two research papers set aggressive glycated hemoglobin targets and compared that strategy with conventional targets in an effort to lower cardiovascular events in diabetes. One study, called ACCORD, stopped its aggressive target arm early when those participants showed a higher death rate. The other study, called ADVANCE, found a benefit for major macro and microvascular events, mostly from a reduction in nephropathy. The commentary on these papers was magnificent, especially a perspective by Harlan Krumholtz and Thomas Lee. They remind us that, quoting, practice is complex, and that ultimately we need to understand a strategy's effects on people, not just on surrogate endpoints. The Annals of Internal Medicine this week had some research that seems to settle the controversy about using long-acting beta agonists in asthma. Earlier studies found them to increase asthma-related deaths. An industry-funded meta-analysis of mostly industry-funded trials comparing salmeterol plus corticosteroids versus corticosteroids alone found no difference between the two regimens for deaths or hospitalizations. The Annals editorialist recommends reserving combination therapy for asthma that's not controlled adequately by steroids alone and only for patients who will be monitored closely and who will seek care when their asthma is uncontrolled. A study in Thursday's New England Journal of Medicine reported that the renin inhibitor aliskiren, used in combination with an angiotensin receptor blocker, lowered albuminuria in patients with diabetes. The work was sponsored by the manufacturer. In Journal Watch Cardiology, Joel Gore says that although this preliminary study showed that aliskiren appeared to offer temporary renal protection, more studies are needed to see whether that protection, quoting, translates into true reductions in kidney failure or cardiovascular events. And in Journal Watch General Medicine, Alan Brett writes that using aliskiren, quoting, solely to reduce albuminuria seems premature. A JAMA study from last week showed that patients who've had a stroke might avoid post-stroke depression with use of preventive therapy. Researchers found that both the antidepressant escitalopram and problem-solving therapy reduced the incidence of depression in these patients relative to those taking a placebo. In Journal Watch Psychiatry, Peter Royburn says that, quoting, post-stroke depression is associated with increased mortality, but is difficult to identify. Therefore, preventive strategies may be more efficient than early detection and treatment. Here's this week's roundtable. Earlier this spring, JAMA published two papers based on an examination of documents used in litigation surrounding Vioxx and its withdrawal from the marketplace. Accompanying those two papers was a strong editorial comment from the editor of JAMA, calling for drastic action against the influence of for-profit companies on research, practice, and education. One of those papers looked at the issues of guest authorship, inviting someone to be an author on a paper describing research they may have had little to do with, and ghostwriting, the practice of outsourcing the writing of reviews and research reports to third parties who go unacknowledged when those reports are published. Dr. Joseph Ross, the first author of that paper, has agreed to discuss his findings with us. Dr. Ross is in the Department of Geriatrics and Adult Development at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Welcome, Dr. Ross. Thanks for taking the time.
No, thanks for your interest.
Well, first I want to ask you for the elevator ride summary of your work. How did you get interested in these questions, and how did you go about exploring them?
Well, We had the opportunity to take a look at the documents through our participation in the litigation as either expert witnesses or consultants. And when our time and within the litigation was finished, we wanted to go back and look through these documents in a systematic way and document some of the practices that we stumbled upon when reviewing the documents that we thought were wrong. So, for instance, when we were involved in the litigation, we had stumbled across some examples of ghostwriting, and we wanted to then go back systematically through the litigation documents that had been cataloged to try and study it almost as a case report in this one instance where we had access.
I see. And Dr. Ross, how many documents were there?
It's actually fairly difficult to say. There were hundreds of thousands of documents that were scanned into an electronic database by one of the plaintiff's attorney firms. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly how many documents there are, unfortunately, because one string of emails could be one document, and then that same string of emails with four more sort of responses back and forth is another document. So it's difficult to say how many distinct documents are, but there were hundreds of thousands at a minimum.
My understanding from reading your materials and method section was that you actually did a search for keywords relating to authorship. Is that right?
Exactly. So this electronic database that was set up, you could search with keywords. So almost as when you're looking for a clinical trial paper on PubMed, you put in a keyword. You're able to pull up some studies that have been done on whatever keywords you put in. We put in some keywords into this database and tried to systematically identify documents that talked about authorship, with a company working with academic physicians, those things to that nature.
And so when you found documents relating to these matters, it seemed to have read them, the ones that fetched up.
Right. Well, so any ones that came up to the keyword, I then sort of read individually, searched through, and looked to see if they were relevant to our wanting to look at ghostwriting and guest authorship. If it was, then we all sort of looked at them, almost coded them in a qualitative way. You know, what is this really about? Is this related to clinical trials? Is this related to review papers? And to try and sort of come to a consensus on what these documents really represented.
And it sounded to me from the way that you wrote the paper that you went in with a kind of an open mind. You didn't have a hypothesis. You just went in and you said, if I can characterize it, well, let's see what these things tell us about authorship.
Exactly. We were suspicious that some these types of practices, this guest authorship, ghostwriting existed. But we didn't go in there testing the hypothesis, yes, they do exist. What we really went in is to try and generate hypotheses in the sense that, but just to look qualitatively at these documents and describe them as a case study.
I see. And so what did you find?
Well, what we essentially found was that for clinical trial manuscripts, we found that company employees or other unacknowledged authors were frequently involved in writing these articles after they had been clearly designed and conducted within the company. And then primary authorship was then attributed to an academically affiliated investigator who had been recruited later onto the study. And the same thing with review papers. Review papers were frequently seemingly conceived within the company, and then they would recruit an academic author, and the person who had actually drafted the paper was not an author on the paper. And the problem with all this is that it tends to taint all the legitimate research that's done by the pharmaceutical industry with physicians, because you can't know when you're reading a paper who actually designed the study, who did the study, who did the statistical analyses of the data, and who interpreted those results, and who actually wrote the paper.
I see. So is it true that some of these writing companies, let's make a distinction between ghost authorship and guest authorship. Some of the companies supplying first drafts of papers would argue that they're just good communicators and they're providing first drafts, which the authors would then okay or change. However, the guest authors are people who may not even have participated in the research, which is a different matter. Would you agree?
Exactly. And it is a complicated issue. You know, the medical writers may contest that they are doing a good service. They're preparing that first copy that's cleaner and it won't need as much editing. But the problem is that a number of decisions are made in writing a manuscript. And when a medical writer working on behalf of the pharmaceutical company is making those initial decisions, it's hard to believe in the objective scientific rigor of the presentation of the data.
How widespread do you think those practices are?
You know, we had the opportunity to look at these documents for one drug made by one company. And I can't say more strongly that I don't think that this is an isolated incident. I don't think that this practice was only done by Merck or done for Vioxx, that medication. I think that this is, unfortunately, a widespread practice. And our impetus, really, for trying to get this information out there is to almost make the medical profession, you know, rethink what is an appropriate role as an author on a paper. What is the appropriate way to conduct research in collaboration with industry? Because industry is important, but academic rigor and objectivity are more important. And we have to be sure that when a person reads a paper, be it a physician, be it a patient, that they can be certain that the evidence presented is as objective and rigorously presented as possible.
So the problem that you see and the problem that you've uncovered here is the fact that papers were written and then authors were invited to lend their names and, I would guess, ostensibly their reputations to the research.
Absolutely. And what we found is that these academic authors were almost always placed in the first, second, and third positions on the paper, regardless of what their role was. And that gives the appearance to the reader that these were the people who were in charge of the paper, and in charge of the entire trial, particularly the first author of a big trial. That's the person who's in charge. That's the person who's making all the decisions. You know, that's the principal investigator. And that's how, in the biomedical community, that's how we attribute responsibility, accountability, and prestige. And so when the companies come along and they recruit authors who weren't involved in the design of the study, they didn't have their statisticians doing the analysis. They weren't the one interpreting those results, but yet their name is first. It gives the appearance of rigor and objectivity that might not have been there.
I see. And on your paper, Dr. Ross, you were the first author, and so you were the main guy.
I was the main guy, yeah. I was the one searching through all those hundreds of thousands of documents.
You were doing all the reading and all the scanning and then sharing the findings with your co-authors. Let me ask you this. Have you ever been approached to be a guest author?
No, I have never been approached to be a guest author.
But do you know of people who have?
Yes.
You do.
I am young in this world. I'm few years out of my research fellowship, but what you hear from mentors and other people in the more senior world is that, you know, you see these emails that come from medical education and communications companies, you know, identifying people as thought leaders, as important leaders in a field. Would they like to work with this group to, you know, put together a paper that will discuss this, or would they like to serve on these committees? And, you know, it happens, and I think it happens frequently.
And since publication of your paper back in April, have people come up to you and said, "Gee, you know, Joe, I've actually been asked recently to do this myself."
Yeah, no. The response to the paper has been very interesting. I think that a lot of people were sort of happy to see this issue discussed publicly. I got a few emails from people in the medical writing world who said, "Wow, I can't you." This is right on. Actually, it's probably worse than what you describe. But I also got emails from people saying, you know, why are you doing this? You know, the doctors are on the up and up. They're being objective, and their involvement improves the science. And so clearly it's a contentious issue. And I think that the best thing for everyone is transparency and being truthful and honest about everyone's role.
What implications do you think that this practice has for looking back at the literature that's out there now? Are we to look back and say, well, there's some research out there that you wonder whether my friend Bill, for instance, really was the first author on this? Is there a need, do you think, for a kind of reevaluation of the evidence?
You know, a paper like ours certainly can open up that kind of ugly can of worms, where we say, well, if it happened here and we think it's happening all over, you know, what does that mean for this paper that was written or for these trials that, you know, pushed us in this direction? And it's really hard to go back. And what I hope is that this paper leads journals, physicians, academic centers to really firmly come together, and the pharmaceutical industry to really come together around a standard set of criteria and requirements and what is appropriate. How should authorship be negotiated? How should collaborations be conducted to ensure the rigor and objectivity of the trials, and move forward in a way that we can be sure that the research that happens from now on isn't tainted, and we know what people's roles were in the trial, in writing the paper, and what people did, so that credit is given where credit is due, and people, patients, physicians can believe what they read in the medical literature.
Have you heard of any policy changes, Dr. Ross, that have occurred since publication of your paper, or any that are contemplated?
Beyond the editorial suggestions made by Dr. DeAngelis and Dr. Fontana Rosa in JAMA, there's nothing that I've heard. I don't know if the ICMJE, the International Committee of Medical Journals Editors, are going to come together and try and develop a more rigorous sort of authorship contribution criteria list that should be required. I don't know what's going to be the next step.
And do you have any, I guess you can't reveal to us in advance, but do you have any other projects, similar projects on the stove now?
We're still thinking about how we can think about these documents that we've had exposure to try and advance the way science and collaborations with industry are being conducted. And so we have some things that we're thinking about.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing those results when they come out. I want to thank you for taking the time this afternoon, Dr. Ross, and to wish you well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Finally, we've got a story about cell phones and brain cancer. Remember that one? The New York Times reported that three neurosurgeons told Larry King that they didn't hold cell phones next to their ears, preferring to use earpieces instead. One explained that he thought it safer to keep that microwave antenna away from his brain. Don't answer that. Thanks for listening. We'd like to listen to you. Call us at 1-617-440-4374 and give us your thoughts, which we'll use here after we verify it's really you who's talking. To that end, leave your name and your phone number at the start of your message. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Have a pleasant weekend. For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Elia.